Nowadays,
we walk these streets like zombies,
wearing dead faces on t-shirts like jerseys. This year, 21 teenagers have been killed, and James was number five.
Young blood, but these tears are getting old. They don't cry anymore. Just hope the dead can make it to heaven alive.
Thought they said you can't die in hell.
They've never been to Flint. We play tag with shanks, double dutching between bullets, monopolizing the streets.
So we hide and seek through hustles,
freeze
at barrels,
and lose at life.
I'm Jennifer White. This hour, we're talking about violence, how it affects kids and communities, and why it matters for all of us. We'll find out why it's so hard to break the cycle of violence and the serious developmental impact violence and trauma have on a young brain. That's ahead this hour on State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. Today, we're exploring how violence affects kids. What do you think would be the best way to reach these kids and provide support? Join in on the conversation at 866-255-2762 or on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. The voices you heard at the very beginning of this program belong to Jaquel Price and Yasmin Davis, two members of Raise It Up, a poetry slam team from Flint. Crime rates in that city are declining, but it is still one of the most violent cities, not just in the state, but in the country. I went there with State of Opportunity reporter Sarah Alvarez to talk to some young people about the effect living in a violent community has on them.
The Haskell Youth Center is on the front lines of violence prevention in Flint. They don't use a complicated formula. There are just plenty of positive activities and positive adults. Today, there will be about 200 kids spread throughout the game room, the cafeteria, and a gym where the basketball games never seem to stop. Haskell is a refuge of sorts. Crime is pervasive in this city, with almost 800 violent crimes since the beginning of the year. That's pretty extreme, but just as true outside of Flint as inside is the effect violence can have on young people.
Yeah, it felt like a storm that always around that won't go away. It's constantly raining all the time, and violence is always around.
This is Rico Colfer. He's 18.
My house has been broken into 3 times, and we done tried 3 different things to prevent it from happening. Every time it happened, it hurts me because I see my mom cry. And she worked hard all the time to get us the best stuff to have, and they just come in and take it.
Cole first started coming to the Haskell Center when he was 9 years old. The center can put kids in touch with emotional support and mentorship. 17-year-old Diamond Howell went into foster care when she was 9. Next week will be the 1-year anniversary of her brother's death. He was shot.
And he was 22. Yeah. Before he even got killed, I'm moving from the system to the system. Like, I don't stay with my mom. I'm not even from Flint. But coming into this city, seeing all this, you know, this is not the life I wanted to live. But I didn't choose this. I mean, everything happened for a reason, and I'm trying to move forward.
Emotionally, Howell carries a lot on her 17-year-old shoulders. Even so, she comes across as very put together. She talks easily about her plan to become a dentist. But she gets visibly anxious and flustered when she talks about her little brother. She's fiercely devoted to him and worries out loud about how he's dealing with the violence around them.
Ain't no telling what he going through. He don't know how to express it. And the way he expresses it is in a bad way. He go act out. So it's like I can't really get to him. So it really like take a toll on me. Like, dang, am I doing everything that I'm supposed to do? Like, I don't want him to go down the wrong way.
These two young people before you probably have witnessed more violent deaths at the age of 16, 17, or 18 than we have in our lifetime. And that's sad.
Officer Jesse Carpenter has been a Flint City police officer for 18 years. He runs the Haskell Center.
For 11 years before I started this program, I stood over the dead bodies, our youth, holding family members back that I knew, because now that teenager is no longer a teenager. It's a crime. It's part of a crime scene. So I'm holding family and friends back, knowing that I want to stand there and hug the deceased as well.
There are lots of things that can help dull the effects of violence and stabilize neighborhoods. Things like the Haskell Center, important in the lives of so many Flint families. But fixing the impact of a lifetime of exposure to violence can be hard. Diamond Howell says the one thing that could make a difference in her life is something no program can easily provide.
I will always ask for my brother back, but for, like, if he wasn't even dead, the thing I would really ask for is, like, my mom. Like, my mama lost us because she's bipolar, schizophrenic. She was really, like, trying her hardest to, you know, get us back and do everything she was supposed to do. When I graduate and start my career, I really want to take care of my mom because she did everything that she could do. She don't want us, you know, having to worry about ducking from bullets. She really, like, scared for us. But I'm like, don't worry, because we got God and it's us. We going to be all right when we, you know, make it out. So it's like, I'm going to be okay, though. I'm going to be okay.
Howell is working hard at being okay. But she says she wants to see more resources directed at helping her peers deal with and overcome violent communities.
It is tough to wrap our heads around the effect of violence and to develop strategies to deal with it. So we're going to turn to one of our most trusted sources and somebody who's thought deeply about this, Jeffrey Canada. He's the founder of the Harlem Children's Zone. He's also the author of Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence. He's in New York. Jeff, thanks for having this conversation with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited to be with you today.
You've spent a lot of time with young people who face violence in their communities. How closely do their stories mirror your story of growing up in violence?
Well, you know, the point I was trying to make in Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun was that violence in poor communities is not new. The difference today than when I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, is that there were no handguns around. Young people acted violently, but they did not fear death. There is a totally different psychological, emotional, and spiritual change that happens with young people when their actions, which are often minor, could lead to death, and they experience other young people dying as a regular and routine occurrence in their lives. This has a devastating impact on a young person's ability to plan, to make reasonable decisions, to act in what might be considered measured ways, because when your life is at stake and you're 14, making a rational decision just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so young people often overreact. They often have this sense of justice, which when you say, why did you shoot that person or how could you do that? It doesn't compute for them because their lives have been overwhelmed by toxic stress and anxiety. It's really devastating for young people.
You've done focused work on both poverty and violence interruption. Which, in your experience, is stickier?
Well, I will tell you what I have experienced. So when I get my young people together and I say, how many of you know someone who's been shot? And 70% of my kids raise their hands. That has an impact on young people, which is separate than just growing up poor. When you honestly can look at your odds of survival and say, well, you know what, it's 50-50, I'll even make it to 20, your ability to do the kind of long-range planning, the kind of delay of gratification necessary to study hard and not get involved in sex and drugs and other kinds of activities, it really becomes diminished. And I think where you find communities that have high violence levels among young people, you find a sense of hopelessness among those young people and a sense of anxiety that often they can't pinpoint what's making them feel this way. And they can't afford the real appropriate mental health that might help them reconcile that anxiety. And it leads to a lot of behaviors which become very self-destructive and very destructive for society at large.
Jeff, let's talk about resources. You know, after mass shootings occur, we see support resources pour into those communities, and rightfully so. But for low-income kids who live with this constant undercurrent of danger, violence, and loss, the kids we talk to say they need more help. So why isn't that happening?
It is one of the tragedies, I think, in our country. There are certain places that we think young people being shot is routine. So you talk about Chicago. Oh, yeah, that's routine. Flint, it's routine. When it happens in a place that's middle class, the first thing you hear people say is, we never expected anything like that to happen in our community. And therefore, people assume, okay, so this is a shock to them. We should provide resources. I tell folks, in the first 15 years of my career, I never expected it in my community either. There is nothing that becomes normalized about violence, and we simply don't respect our children enough to provide them the mental health supports that they need whenever someone is seriously injured. When this happens in Bedford-Stuyvesant or Harlem or Flint or Chicago, nothing happens. The kid doesn't even get any counseling. No one even says anything, and I think that is devastating.
Where does that lack of expectation come from, though?
Well, I think that in lots of these places, we think of these kids differently than we think of our own kids. And this is really a problem. And sometimes it's wrapped up in race. They're certainly wrapped up in class. And people just think, well, you know what? Everybody's in gangs over there, so that's what happens when you're in gangs. They forget that these children are 13, 14, 15, and they are really kids, and they're our kids. And we have to think about them the same way we would think if our child was exposed to something. And I just try to remind people, imagine if your son or daughter knew one of their friends who was murdered. I mean, what length would you not go to ensure their mental health and their spiritual health?
That's Jeffrey Canada, and we'll continue our conversation with him in just a moment. We'll also try to understand the effect of violence on the development of a young person's brain and how to help undo that damage. Call us at 866-255-2762 or share your thoughts on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. What do you think is missing from the conversation about violence and young people? You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. We know how traumatic witnessing and experiencing violence can be for young people, but not all young people are getting help moving past and healing the effects of living with violence. We continue our conversation with Jeffrey Canada. He said one of the reasons he started the Harlem Children's Zone was to keep kids safe, so I asked him what approach he took.
Well, you know what? I think that adults have to be the ones who keep kids safe. So in the zone, when our kids are threatened, guess what happens? My staff is standing on street corners, and we're saying to everyone, be they in gangs or not in gangs, you're not going to harm our children. There is a strong message that goes out when the adults say, we're in charge, and we're not going to let a bunch of 14 and 15-year-olds run our community. There are places where the adults feel so under siege that they themselves are afraid of the children. They're afraid to come out. They're afraid to take a stand. They believe, you know, if I go out there, they're going to kill me. We decided that this is worth fighting for. And we want our kids to walk knowing the adults are going to protect them. And it doesn't mean that there are not shootings in Harlem. There are. It just simply means that if we hear even the slightest indication that there's going to be a problem, we flood our streets with adults who stand there and give safe passage to kids. So our kids grow up with the sense that the adults are here to protect us. Therefore, I don't have to protect myself by getting a weapon or joining a gang.
That points to one of the tensions I see in this conversation around violence in low-income neighborhoods, and that's the right way to approach it. Some people say, look, there are bad kids in these streets. We need stronger punishments.
Other people say, look, they're kids in bad situations, and what we need is better prevention. So, you know, if there is ongoing violence, how do we straddle that line?
Well, I think that the evidence is really clear. Locking up kids en masse, which is what they did in California, will create a situation that's 10 times worse. You send these kids to institutions, they turn into gladiator schools. This is not to say we should coddle or we should not have real punishment for kids when they break the law. It is saying the removal of all resources except the criminal justice ones for young people is a disaster. You end up with a situation where your jails are filled to overflowing the way California's jails are. At a cost is exorbitant, and you get nothing in return. You need a real measured response. You need to flood these neighborhoods with the kind of supports that keep young people under the watchful eye of caring adults. I tell people we're in direct competition with the gangs. And when the gangs are recruiting, my programs have to be open. And it calls for extraordinary efforts, but guess what? It works. And it costs much less than incarcerating these young people. You know, in our city, New York City, it costs $157,000 a year to lock up an adult, not a juvenile. It's even more expensive, over $200,000 for a juvenile. That is ridiculous. It is crazy. We should not be spending that money that way. We should be spending money in communities that we know young people have historically ended up in a criminal justice system. We do it in the Harlem Children's Zone. It could be done in other places. You do need the resources to do it, but we're spending the money anyhow.
One of the questions we also get is, you know, what about the parents? And in your book, you talk about the challenge parents face in preparing their kids to survive in environments where there is a lot of violence. Explain that tension.
Well, you know what? I wrote in Fistic, Knife, Gun how my mother, who was raising four boys, was terrified we would grow up to be victims and sent my oldest brother out to fight because someone had taken the coat of my younger brother, and how that seemed to her to be the right thing to do. But I found it absolutely terrifying that in the end, as a four-year-old or a five-year-old, I would have to learn how to fight just to be able to go outside the door. But parents feel lost. They don't know what else to do. What we say to parents is, you know, have your kid in a safe place where the adults will guarantee their protection. And then you don't have to spend all that time and energy worried about them and learning to defend themselves.
When people watch the news or read newspapers, it can feel like violence is contained within communities. So the thinking we hear is, you know, it's not my problem. I just won't visit that place. Does the fix need to come from within the community, or is it everybody's problem?
Well, you know, when you start thinking of these places and, you know, the Littletons, the Paducahs, the Sandy Hooks, this issue, when you think about what's been happening on college campuses, this is no longer contained in the inner cities. It is totally out of control.
Jeffrey Canada is the founder of the Harlem Children's Zone. He's also the author of Fist, Stick, Knife, Gun, A Personal History of Violence. Jeff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And joining us now is Jim Henry. Jim runs the Children's Trauma Assessment Center at Western Michigan University. Jim, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, we heard from young people in Flint and then from Jeff Canada that there aren't enough resources going to help young people trying to process the violence around them. But your center is dedicated to helping young people who have experienced trauma. What do you do?
After working 17 years in Child Protective Services and seeing many, many children and not recognizing that the system doesn't understand the harm that has been done to the brains of our children, and that's what trauma does, and chronic exposure to violence. We started a transdisciplinary center that involves a pediatrician, social work, occupational therapy, speech and language, to look at these children holistically in a comprehensive way to say, what has been the impact of personal violence to them in their functioning, in their ability to have relationships, in their ability to learn. This is what we wanted to help people move out of, thinking that, gee, all you have to do is move them out of the situation and they'll be fine. But at something has happened to the brain that needs to be assessed. And then once we know what that is, then what do we do about it? And I think that's just so important.
Explain some of what we see happening in brain development when kids are exposed to trauma or violence, especially over a long period of time.
Well, what we know about the brain develops from the bottom up, from the brainstem to our thinking center, which is called the neocortex. And when you are chronically exposed to violence, your brain development is compromised. And so what happens is you can't access your higher levels of thinking, like your prefrontal cortex. And so you, in some ways, you get stuck in your emotional system. It's called the limbic system. And you are triggered into this, what we would define as fight, flight, and freeze, because the world becomes dangerous. And when we're in danger, and certainly Jeffrey spoke of anxiety to the nth degree, that then the brain moves into protection, primal protection. And so we then can't learn, we can't function, because we don't have safety. And so the brain is compromised. And the more chronic exposure, the more the brain begins to be continuously triggered into protection and into extreme behaviors, which can range from aggression to withdrawal.
Is this new science? Because what you're describing is something that I don't hear a lot of people talking about.
We are very fortunate that in the last 15 years, there have been significant findings on the brain that tell us now that this is not a willful choice, that it's no longer should I hit Tommy or should I not, but my brain sees danger. And when you see danger and you've been living in danger, you move to protect yourself. And so this new research has moved it from theory to science. And this is a significant paradigm shift for our country, because we have traditionally held that kids make good choices or kids make bad choices. But when the brain gets wired for danger, that shifts. And so when children aren't safe and easily triggered, they aren't making a 50-50, should I do this or should I not? But they're acting in a way that the brain says, protect yourself, protect yourself. And so this is significant change for our perception of children and adults in our country.
But how widespread is this approach of trauma-informed care?
Well, it is, as we like to say at our center, it's moving to the tipping point, that there is significant effort across the country to bring trauma everywhere. And so I'm happy to say the state of Michigan Department of Human Service, Child Welfare, has now adopted trauma-informed child welfare practice. Significant. Several places across the country, we're moving to this in our schools, in our courts, in our social service systems. And so this is changing. It is shifting. And as in anything, it takes time. But it is backed by science, which then draws such a positive support, because it's not just an idea. Let me show you the MRI. Mm-hmm. Let me show you what this looks like in the brain.
We're speaking with Jim Henry. He runs the Children's Trauma Assessment Center at Western Michigan University. You can also join the conversation. If you grew up in a violent community, what made the difference for you? Call us at 866-255-2762 or share your thoughts on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. You know, Jim, when we talk about how to heal kids, how to help them get away from that reactive behavior, what works for them?
Along with the science of the brain is the science of resiliency. And resiliency is how to overcome adversity. And so when we talk about how do we overcome adversity, it's we need some basic things. And one of the most basic things that is most significant is that we feel valued, we feel connected to another human being, and we feel protected if you're a child. And so there's a sense of relatedness. And when all of us, whether we've been traumatized or not, have difficulties, we seek someone out who brings us safety, who makes us feel cared for. And so one is a sense of connection. The second is a sense of competency that all of us need to feel that we can have an effect on our environment. And if you're chronically exposed to danger and violence, you become victimized. And when you're victimized, you feel that you have no ability to influence, to be effective, other than to be protected. All right. So things like sports, things like school. We know that kids who do well in school are far more likely to overcome and be resilient because they have some success. And the third is, how do we help our kids regulate? I so appreciated what Jeffrey from the Harlem Children's Center said, was that when they anticipate some violence happening, they bring the adults into the area. Because what adults can do for children is they can help them regulate. In some ways, they become the external brain, and they, by their regulation, they can help our children regulate. But regulation is a skill. And so we assume when a child is 12, 14, that they have these skills. And kids who've been exposed to violence, that overdeveloped limbic area of the brain really compromises that skill building. So in some ways, they look 14 and are 14, but developmentally, they're like 7. Mm-hmm. And so that is a skill that we as adults have to continually work to rewire the brain, and that comes through repetition and care.
Do you get pushback from people who say, you know, you're making excuses for kids, they have to be accountable for their behaviors, you know, especially when you get into the teenage years, that you can't just give them a pass?
I'm very happy to say that the new director of the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention for the federal government recently spoke at a conference, which I heard him, and he said, we have to be trauma-informed if we're going to help our juvenile delinquents, right? That this is something that has to be on every probation officer's mind, and what are we going to do about it? And he said very clearly, I get it. My probation officers don't. We need to get this out. So this is a shift in recognizing that what we have done in terms of punishment, as Jeffrey talked about, has not worked. How do we help rewire the brain to create positive outcomes? And it is not giving excuses. It's recognizing if – and let me put it in this context. If somebody comes into the room and is in a wheelchair and obviously has a cast on their leg, we don't yell at them, get up, walk around, do what you got to do. We say, wow, you can't do that. What can we do to help you in order to be able to rehabilitate to be able to walk again? We don't do that with the brain. The brain is equally as harmed, and yet because we don't believe behavior tells us about the brain, we say it's just because you want to.
Hmm. So what you're describing is a serious paradigm shift. I mean, you can talk about the science, but not everyone is going to be receptive to the science. On sort of a gut level, what needs to happen to get not just the probation officers, not just the folks who are working in your field, but everyday people understand that trauma-informed care is a necessity if we want to turn the tide?
Well, whenever you change a paradigm that's built into the culture, all right, that all behavior is willful and we evaluate moral as good or bad, that recognition is very difficult to change. And I think that science helps that. I think that when we and Jeffrey again talked about our children, when the community sees that it is all our problem and that we can do something about trauma, that's the positive spin that everyone who's involved in a child's life, from a school teacher to the minister to the court, that when we all see we can build relationship, we can give these kids chances of success, and we can teach them the skills of regulation, then people begin to feel empowered to do something. It's not just let's send this kid to therapy. It's not just spending more money. It's changing the people around, the community people, the neighbor next door, to view the behavior differently through a lens that not why did you do that, but what happened to you.
We had a comment from Samuel on our Facebook page. He says, a society that fears violence is one that primes itself to be destroyed by it. There's a level of aggression that's necessary in order for a peaceful and productive life to unfold, yet we teach our youth to be risk and violence averse. It is not a black and white issue of yes violence, no violence, appreciating what situations require aggression, what it is and is not appropriate. That's a dialogue worth having. Do you agree?
Yes, that we all, because it's wired into us, have a need to protect ourselves. And so it is when your life is in constant danger that it gets to the extreme. And so that you can't regulate that aggression. And so you're easily triggered and you can't read real danger in the environment. You see everything as dangerous.
Just as we wrap up here, Jim, if there's something you want people to take away from what you've observed and experienced in this field, what would it be?
That we all have a responsibility to help our kids heal. And in that healing, we offer them a value, a connectedness, and opportunities for success.
Jim Henry runs the Children's Trauma Assessment Center at Western Michigan University. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Still ahead, there are folks working with young people to interrupt the cycle of violence in communities, and we'll hear from them next. And we want to hear from you. What do you think is missing when we talk about kids and the cycle of violence? If you grew up in a violent community, what made the difference for you? And maybe you think, you know, there's something missing in this conversation about kids and violence. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 866-255-2762. That's 866-255-2762. You can also share your thoughts on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. You're listening to a special State of Opportunity program from Michigan Radio. It's State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. We're talking about violence this hour, how it affects developing brains, and how it affects communities. Joining us now are three people working with young people to break the cycle of violence and provide much-needed support in those young people's lives. Amy Good is the CEO of Alternatives for Girls in Detroit. She's here with Jasmine, a peer educator in that program. We're also joined by Phil Black, the CEO and founder of the Manhood Project, also based in Detroit. Amy, Jasmine, Phil, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having
us.
Thanks for having us.
So one of the issues we bump up against when we talk about violence and young people is that balance between punishment and prevention. How do you support young people who may be victim or perpetrator or both? Phil, I'll come to you first.
So one of the things we recognize in dealing with a young man is seeing how they don't necessarily feel the preventative part. A lot of times they perceive most of the acts towards them as being the punishment. So what we look to do is to help them to recognize what actual services and individuals that they have within not only their family but also in their community who are there to support them. So once they begin to have an understanding and see from an open perspective that, you know, I do have these services available to me, it helps to lead the conversation in pushing them towards them, because one the biggest issue is for them is just the identification piece. To understand that, you know, it isn't you. Everyone isn't against you. You have a number of individuals that are there for you.
What about you, Amy?
I think what's important to keep in mind and to be guided by is to look at the data and what the data say about what works. And in our experience, what works is lots and lots of interventions from lots of different angles, repeated, consistent, that send those messages of providing positive activities to replace downtime, to send messages of support that young people do have choices, and with support they can access a wide range of positive choices and really make headway.
Jasmine, now you're 17. You're the youngest person on our panel today. I'm so glad you're here, because I want to hear from your perspective when you're talking to your peers. What do they say they need?
I think it's more guidance with your parents. Like, I just think that
the parents actually needs to be there with their children. Because at the end of the day, when they get older, they can say, well, maybe I didn't have the best of the life, but my parents were still there for me. I just say it's all about that. And I say different people are being brought up in different situations. So, like, if you're constantly yelling at a person, you never know if they're at home and their parents always yelling at them. They're not going to listen to it. I think it's more just talking in one-on-one sessions.
So more of that one-on-one attention and mentorship is helpful.
Yes.
Now, you both work, all three of you work in programs that are gender-specific. Phil, do you think there are things that boys need that's different from what girls need?
I don't know if it's necessarily that it's different. I do believe it looks differently. For our boys, I can say it's really simple. They're looking, Jim mentioned earlier, they're looking for they're simply looking for love. They're looking for love, and they're looking for safe spaces. So when we look at those two basic needs, you know, I believe that doesn't have a gender attached to it. As far as our boys are concerned, when we talk about that love piece, it looks for them, it is understanding that they are they're really worth the time. They're really worth they're valued as individuals and not just simply looked at as problems.
Amy, what about for girls? Do you think there are specific things girls need to learn about themselves and other girls in order to move out of that cycle of violence?
Absolutely. We find that girls play different roles, generally speaking, in dynamics of violence. Girls are perpetrators of violence more than they used to be, but still way less than boys. And often when girls engage in violence, it's often a response or defense in response to a cycle of violence. In gangs, for example, girls are often pawns. They're traded or treated as bounty or spoils of the outcome of gang conflict. They learn helplessness. I think that we have to counter messages from the media and lots of different directions that are different for girls than for boys. Girls need to learn to value themselves beyond being sex objects and beyond an attachment to a boy or a man. Girls tend to be stronger in mediation skills but need to learn to defend and protect themselves. They have to equip themselves to provide for themselves ultimately so they don't get into positions where they're vulnerable to exploitation.
We're speaking with Phil Black, the CEO and founder of the Manhood Project, Amy Good, CEO of Alternatives for Girls in Detroit, and Jasmine, one of the peer educators with that program. And we want to bring Angela from Grand Rapids into the conversation. Angela, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
And did you have a question?
I did have a question, but I wanted to just add a comment. And I really appreciate what Jim was saying regarding trauma. And then also just listening to your youngest panelist there talking about how important family is. I wanted to say that my partner and I adopted our two children from the foster care system. And they came from a really significant trauma history as well, which plays out huge in their everyday life. And there's really not a lot of support out there for these families, for adoptive families, for families working with families working with these children or these children with trauma who live in their houses. So that's the comment that I just wanted to make. You know, it was kind of different off from what's currently going on. But
that's an important point. And Phil, you had something to share.
Yes. And so I would also say to add to that piece, you know, I had an opportunity to speak with Jim earlier. And I think it's really important that we do bring the adults into the room to help train them in trauma, because what I found is that a lot of times we don't necessarily look at the issues that our young children face as being traumatic, as being something that they go through and have to deal with on a consistent basis. So in bringing adults into the room to train them on this, to help them to change their perspective when dealing with our young men and our young women, I think it really goes a long way to help us support them as opposed to just simply deal with them from a punitive standpoint.
Angela, I'm curious, as a foster parent, what kind of training would be helpful for you in dealing with your foster kids who have experienced some trauma?
Well, we ended up adopting our foster kids. So as adoptive parents, what was offered through the one organization locally, AFSN, that supports adoptive parents, was a really specific class dealing, training parents how to parent these kids differently, much differently than what is usually, you know, taught, as far as like consequences and love and logic and those types of parenting classes. This was a lot different.
More of a trauma-informed care perspective of parenting.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's just not a lot that's offered here in regards to that.
Angela, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you.
You know, Amy, one of the questions that always comes up, and I think Jasmine actually mentioned it, is, you know, where are the parents and what responsibility do they carry? Is it a lack of understanding? Is it that, you know, they're part of the cycle that their kids are now caught up in?
Yeah, we have found that our most powerful and successful interventions have been those that incorporate and strengthen the entire family. We find that parents, I mean, of course, there's the whole range. Some parents are caught up in distractions that prevent them from being there to support their children. But for the most part, we find that parents are eager and almost sometimes desperate to provide the right kind of support. As Angela said, sometimes it's unclear with parents what steps to take. But one of the things that we've developed at Alternatives for Girls is a program for strengthening families. And we strengthen the families and help build. It's not just an educational group of family members, but it also builds a support group for families. So families, parents can support one another, children can support one another, and it helps them as a family unit, very intentionally strengthens them as a family unit and helps them to better prepare to prevent and respond and cope with incidents of violence. And that is powerful.
We're speaking with Amy Good, CEO of Alternatives for Girls in Detroit, Jasmine, one of the peer educators with that program, and Phil Black, founder of the Manhood Project. And we'd still like to hear from you. Call us at 866-255-2762 or share your thoughts on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. If you grew up in a community where you experienced a lot of violence, was there something that turned the tide for you? I'd like to take a question now from Naisha Valdez with Young Nation. This is a community development project in Detroit.
Are youth being a part of the processes that are changing their life and asking them directly what they need instead of trying to assume? And it's not hard. It's just kind of having a conversation, right?
So, Phil, you know, how much do you take away from the young men you're working with, the young boys you're working with, you know, and asking them, you know, what do you need? What can we give you?
Absolutely. So that's critical. I think in one of the biggest findings I've had in doing this work is that realizing that as adults, we don't like to listen. And, you know, sometimes we go in with that attitude as if, hey, you know, I know what you need. And it is really important to sit down and, you know, do almost a full needs analysis on, you know, what our children are dealing with. So that's what we look to do. Within our program, we have a segment which we call Locker Room. And Locker Room is simply just allowing the young man to come in and talk about what current issues that they're dealing with. And we do peer mediation where, you know, we allow them to come up with constructive alternatives for the challenges that they're facing, and it has been very beneficial to a lot of our young men. Mm.
Jasmine, do you feel like you have a voice in this process? I know you're talking to some of your peers, but, you know, as someone sort of representing them, do you feel like you have a voice?
I really do. Now that I'm in this program, Alternatives for Girls, we go out and talk to people, well, talk to teens that's at shelters, about HIV, sex, just anything in that general. And I think it's better for them to hear from someone my age than from someone that's older. They might think, oh, she don't know what she's talking about, or they just don't want to hear it. But I think if they hear from me or someone in general around my age, I think they will listen more.
Hmm. We had a question on Twitter from Leah Carpenter, and she says, you know, ultimately, does breaking the cycle of violence require a long-term investment in families? She says 20 to 30 years. And Amy, is that really what we're looking at?
Yes. In fact, I would say that it involves an investment that we should just consider permanent, a permanent investment. We have to persistently promote the message that we as adults, as youth, as families, as communities, we do not accept violence. And we have to continue the messages and the interventions and the support from many different angles to promote that message. We don't accept violence. As Mr. Canada was saying, violence cannot be viewed as the norm or routine for anyone. And we have to continue to provide, you know, concrete access to positive activities, peer support, peer involvement. We have to promote not just leadership opportunities, but also anti-violence skills in a very concrete way, as well as, you know, a spiritual way among our youth. It has to be long term. I don't think we should even look to an end.
Earlier this hour, Jeff Canada called this epidemic of violence a national crisis. Just this week in Detroit, a young boy was killed sleeping in his bed by a stray bullet that came through his home. It seems like this conversation has been going on for a long time. What do you think, Phil, is going to have to happen for there to be a national turn of focus, a statewide turn of focus, or just some directed attention that it's not just important when it happens in my community, but it matters no matter where it's happening?
That's a great question. I believe that bringing more people to the table to have this type of a conversation is a starting point. But it does. It has to be broader. There has to be, in some way, an opportunity for us to begin to make some significant changes in how we portray the images of our young adults and the violence that we spread within through the media and things of that nature. And because I really do believe that when we do that, we help them and begin to promote the positive things that are happening. It gives them a great opportunity to see alternative images, and it helps to change the mindset.
We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've been speaking with Phil Black, founder of the Manhood Project, Amy Good, CEO of Alternatives for Girls, and Jasmine, one of the peer educators for that program. Thank you so much. And please continue this conversation, Phil, Amy, and Jasmine, on our Facebook page. I'm sure people have more questions for you. To conclude this hour, we'll listen to the rest of the piece about violence from the Slam Poets, written and performed by Jaquel Price and Yasmin Davis from Raise It Up in Flint.
We can't even freestyle, speak without tripping over gang slang, so we articulate our colloquialisms just right.
So just in case this phrase is our last, that'll be hard enough to carve into tombstones. Etch-a-sketched into hearts.
And dope enough to be the opening lines at our funerals. Pop!
Another t-shirt.
Pop!
Another jersey.
Pop!
Another teardrop from the sky. Cause all that seems to cry around here is the earth hurt
that we pollute her womb with tombs. Too bad you can't recycle souls, cause James could've used another chance. Take a trip down the back alleys of memories when the streets were paved with fresh bricks instead of people selling it.
When children's games were just games.
When tag was just tag.
When you could hopscotch on anyone's block and not get shot.
When choosing a favorite color wasn't choosing a lifestyle.
When our biggest worries were catching up with the ice cream man.
Not living through this neighborhood.
It's killing us. Hoping the death of our failure will revive its success, but we give birth just in time for it to kill our fathers, mothers, sisters,
and brothers.
So the cycle starts again.
And again and again. Same game, new target, same experience, old tears. See, it's because of the cycle that I will never hear my brother's voice again.
Gun aimed and fired.
Gun aimed and fired. To the sound of bullets and a cracked skull rained the night almost as storming as the blood pouring from the back of his head.
This is Flint.
This was James.
This is how we live.
This is how he died.
Pop!
Another t-shirt.
Pop!
Another number.
Pop!
Another sad tweet. Another empty seat at family functions. The cycle took my brother from me, leaving behind these abstract memories. But see, we have become so immune to these stories.
Like our emotions developed antibodies towards death.
We don't cry at funerals anymore.
Just hope the dead can make it to heaven alive.
That was Flint, written and performed by Jaquel Price and Yasmin Davis from Raise It Up in Flint. You've been listening to a special State of Opportunity call-in show from Michigan Radio. Continue to share your thoughts with us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity or tweet us at State of Op with two P's. And if you think you can be a resource for this project, go to stateofopportunity.org/michiganradio.org and click on the Share Your Story link. State of Opportunity was produced and directed by Sarah Alvarez and Allie Billings with help from Lucy Perkins. The program was engineered by Zoe Clark. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer White.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.